We'll find mysteries in the monastery today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Is Bertrand Maccabee really Dr. Joseph McCaffrey in disguise? We'll ask the latter about the former, then ask Garrison Keillor for the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. You have a lot of explaining to do. I mean, you have a resume that is simply astounding. Let's start with the monastery. What led you to the monastery and what led you out?
Youthful indiscretion.
In or out.
Maybe we should stop right there.
I entered the Dominican Order. An order known for its prosecutions of heretics and so on, entered that order at the age of 18 at Providence College, and then I stayed in the order for 6 years, just before theology, at which time I left.
In what position? Were you a brother or a pastor?
I was in training to be a priest.
Okay.
Yeah, but I left before that.
Okay.
So you don't have to refer to me as ex-father or anything.
No. I'm one of those, too. But I only lasted 2 years.
Well, I lasted six.
That's quite a stretch.
Yeah, it was a stretch. And it was a bad stretch in the last year.
So. Well, that's why I decided to teach rather than become a pet. My congregation moves every 4 years. I don't have to.
But that, you know, that is an interesting thing in life, though. I certainly found it so. The desire, the decision to enter, and then the decision to leave.
Yeah.
Those are difficult.
Very difficult. Very difficult. It wasn't that difficult for me to join.
Oh, yeah. Joining is easy.
Yes, because at 18, you know, the future is the future, and you don't think that much sometimes. But it was very difficult to leave because once I tie into something, I'm very hesitant to leave it.
You know,
I'm very stubborn.
That's true. Once you commit to something, leaving is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And that's true whether you commit to a priestly order or a philosophy or anything else. Once you lock yourself in, it takes a crowbar to get you out.
Yeah, yeah.
But out you came. And then where?
Well, then I got I picked up a job at St. Ambrose. I was going to go continue on for my doctorate. I had finished with a master's degree and a licentiate degree, which is a Roman degree that entitles me to teach at any seminary in the world. So I said, you know, I have to. I felt I was coming out of a prison in a way. I'd been locked away, especially for the last 4 years, in a very, very serious monastic environment. And all we did was study and pray. That's essentially what it was. And so I said, well, I have to experience life a little bit, and maybe I should try to hunt out a job. And I wrote to a few schools. It was very late for me to get a job at that time. It was in August, and at any rate, St. Ambrose just had someone who violated his contract and left, and they were in desperate need of a philosopher. At that time, philosophers could get jobs.
That's true.
So they hired me. They interviewed me on the phone. They got nice letters about me and things like that, but never interviewed me personally.
Mm-hmm.
So when I flew into the Quad Cities, they were very nervous. Monsignor Menke, who was the president, came out to the airport to pick me up.
I remember Sebastian well.
Trying to figure out what did we get ourselves into. So it was only – I was only going to do this for a year or two, stay here, and then I was going to go back east again. But I got into the community, and the rest is history.
Yeah. I've been here. Well, now, you didn't stay at Ambrose. You left and came back, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I did a few things. I was president of Palmer Junior College, and I was the vice president for academic affairs at the Chiropractic Institute for a little bit. But I was always on a leave of absence from St. Ambrose. I would never take another job unless I knew I could get back to the classroom, because that's my first love, is mm-hmm. teaching. And so I didn't mind doing an administrative position for a year, 2 years, 3 years max, as long as I knew I could get back and escape. Because my feeling is that collegiate administration after about 4 or 5 years does serious damage to the administrators. And they're never really able to come back successfully. Uh-huh. So I always had that thought in my mind, I got to get back to teaching. And always insisted on a leave of absence kind of a contract.
You know, teaching is tough. Of the many things I've done in my life, teaching is the most difficult. And yet, when it works, it is absolutely glorious.
Yeah.
It is the greatest joy in life. If you're truly communicating with students or into the subject and are thinking
right.
and are responding,
right.
What better way to spend your time?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree, Don.
And I will embarrass you by saying that over the years, your students write extravagantly flattering things about you as a teacher. I don't believe any of that, but, you know. It's,
well, I don't either. So we're on.
But we have you here as a writer of mysteries. How does this involvement in the monastery and medieval philosophy prepare you to write mysteries?
Well, I guess it starts this way, is from the age of – in my 20s, I would always go to sleep reading mystery stories. It was just my way of clearing my mind away from whatever else
what
I was doing.
What intrigued you about mysteries?
I don't know.
Most kids don't get involved in mysteries that early.
Yeah, I just don't know. I guess it's – maybe it's a metaphor for – what life is. It's a mystery. And at any rate, they intrigue me.
Mysteries by writers?
Now, this is the curious thing about me, and it's a quirk. I don't remember authors' names and titles. I'm terrible at it.
Oh,
but
I'm glad to find somebody else with that malady.
People say, you know, what book did you read? Well, I read 4 books last week, but don't ask me the titles
right,
of them.
Okay.
What significance is that? But anyway, your question is well taken. So I went from Agatha Christie to up to Michael Connelly to you name them, and I've read them probably. Could you tell me, is there a particular book that I remember? No. But what's happened, though, I think in reading all of those – they all had an effect on what I thought a good mystery story should be. And that's what I'm trying to write, what I think a good mystery story is.
Yeah. Well,
and that's my take on things. So in answer to your question is well taken. I should remember who these writers are and what these books are, but I'm afraid my memory is pretty lousy about that stuff.
Only ones I remember are Ross Macdonald. I thought he was
– oh, yes. Excellent.
He was the one to come after Hammett mm-hmm. and Chandler, and then I thought he was the peak of that. He was as good as you get.
Yep.
And then I love Peter Robinson and his Yorkshire detective. Mm-hmm. I was put onto that by someone who spent a lot of time in York. And but other than that, and Camilleri, those silly Italian things, that's about all I remember in terms of authors. But it is not only a diversion, but it can be an affliction. You know, you pick up a book and you read it in an evening, and then, well, next night I'll read another book, and away you go.
Yep.
But still, how did you make the turn? What decided you? What turned you onto writing mysteries?
Well, as I've read them, I would find fault with some of them, the way they were laid out, the plotting techniques, and so on. And I just said, you know, I should do this. I have time. You know, there's just so much time you can devote to teaching and studies and stuff like that. I need a divertissement. And I said, you know, why not write a book? Why not write one? Why not invent a character who has a facsimile of identification with me. He's mm-hmm. not exactly me. And and the thing that triggered me, actually the thing that triggered it, was at one point in my life I was offered a job with a private investigation agency. They sought me out and they said, we'd like you to consider a job with us. So I was at a path here. Do I go teaching again, or do I bite on this lure that was put out there? And I said, no, I'm not going to do this. I want to teach. That's the game for me. However, wouldn't it be interesting now, if I'm going to start writing a novel, wouldn't it be interesting to invent a character who pursued a career in detection, a PI, and then mm-hmm. take him as kind of an alternate to my ego and send him out into the world with detective stories? So that's how that began. And I've written 10 of them, and they revolve around things that I've experienced in my life, travels and so on and so on and so on. Plots come to me, I think about them, and then I develop the story. But I never know how it's going to end.
Oh, well.
I never know how the story is going to end.
Isn't that unusual? I thought, isn't it Agatha Christie said you think of the ending first and then twist back there?
No, I think of the catch in the plot, and then I let the story go.
Okay.
So, for example, I had one of my nieces, I put her in the story. I said, well, I'll use your name in the story. And she said, oh, that's really exciting. Please do that. I'd love to see my name in print and stuff. Well, it happened to be halfway through the novel I had to kill her. And I told her, I said, you know, hey, Ian, I have some bad news for you. I killed you off. And she said, I want my name off of that book. But I didn't mean to kill her. I thought she was going to be in the book. But the way the book evolves, I just let it evolve, and I don't know where it's going to go sometimes. I have a rough idea of how it's going to end, but how I'm going to get there, it's a very tricky route. So,
could you give us a sample of your writing? You have one of your mysteries in front of you.
Well, I brought this book with me, and I'll just read the first page, the prologue of the book, which I don't usually use prologues, but in this case I did. When word reached him of the breach, a current of fear ran through him. He was at a loss. How could it be? Pierre Collin told him that heaven and earth would be moved to rectify this most unlikely occurrence. Could it be possible that this theft, and it was that pure and simple, would come back onto him and cause him to lose his most valuable possession? He was unduly pessimistic by his own admission and Cologne's revelation, but it was causing him to harbor hugely depressing thoughts. He got up and headed into the cavernous room behind his library. Soft, nuanced lighting filled the room, at whose center stood the object, which by itself overshadowed every other piece in the room and, in fact, his entire castle. Often for hours at a time he would sit on his kingly stuffed chair and just gaze at the piece while thinking about its history and even more so the sheer beauty of the thing. Yes, Pierre Collin, the hulking, menacing Corsican, had better move heaven and earth. The loss of this object would essentially carve the heart out of his being. Amidst these thoughts, a goodly part of the day passed away. So that's the prologue to a book called A Case of Silver.
Question. Maccabee, is that drawn from the Bible?
I was just going to ask that.
You know, actually it is. Nobody's ever caught that. So congratulations to both of you. And you catch it. You don't catch it necessarily from the way it's spelled in the book.
No.
But you catch it. And when I've put these books, I've put about five of my books on audio, which I think actually they come out much better on audio than when you read them.
Well, you sure read well.
Thank you. I've never heard. I don't read them. I have a reader do it for me who's really good. And in typical Maccabee fashion, he was just about to complete a book. 3 weeks ago, he was within 25 pages of completing the book, and he had a massive stroke.
Whoa. Oh, my.
But that's kind of a Maccabee occurrence in some of these books. But But anyway, so Maccabee is that way. And then the other key to this that I never tell anybody is Bertrand was my name as a monk, Brother Bertrand.
Okay.
That was the next question.
Bertrand Maccabee.
you're accustomed to Bertram, but Bertrand is different.
No, I was Bertrand, named after a Dominican saint by the name of St. Louis Bertrand, who was famous for one thing.
What?
He never smiled in his life.
Well, you are.
He
no
was a true Dominican.
You're no credit to the saints. Yeah, so noticed two of your books had to do with harness racing.
Yes.
And in two of your books, as I recall, there's somebody with a serious, almost a fatal illness. How did you happen to come back to harness racing?
Well, harness racing was something that my son got very interested in and was actually a trainer in Chicago, a harness trainer in Chicago. Now he works for Thoroughbreds and is the executive secretary for Thoroughbreds. So that got me into harness racing. You know, I got very familiar with it out here at the Quad City Downs. And then David drew my interest, and then I developed two stories around the harness industry.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you hear that when you're around an author, be careful, because he can garbage up any part of your life and make it into a book.
That's right.
We ran into Fletcher Knable, who was here in town at our request years ago. And I found out in discussions with people, features that showed up in his next book. It was startling, but I thought, yeah, I guess that's the way it works.
Well, maybe in my next book, the Maccabee will have an interview with two celebrated people from Augustana.
We'll see if we can find a couple for it.
But hope you don't have your name in the book, because like my niece, you may disappear halfway through the book.
What's the relationship between what I guess I can call your calling, because you seem passionate about it, your teaching, and your mysteries? Is writing mysteries escape, or is it simply another way of carrying out a calling?
Yeah, I think it's carrying out a calling. It's an escape a bit, too. It gets my mind onto other tracks and so on. I do. Lately, I've been trying to integrate the books into my travels. So, for example, the book that I just read a little bit from, A Case of Silver, involves a very famous Arab Muslim, Al-Adrisi, back in the 12th century, who was a famous geographer and is hired by Roger II in Palermo to develop a map of the world, because the guy was so widely traveled. He developed a map, but he also created for Roger II, and they think it was a surprise for Roger II, although I doubt that given what Roger II was. But he acted surprised, I believe. He created a 400-pound block of silver, okay, which replicated his map of the world on one side and then the Ptolemaic solar system on the other side. It disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to it. But this is what this book is all about. It gets me into the context of the book locally, and then I end up going over to places that I visited: Algeria, Tunisia, Sicily, and so on. And I've integrated those things into my studies, which those are related to my medieval Renaissance philosophy class, but they are also integrated into the book. And the book, of course, is going to argue that this block of silver exists, but it exists in some clandestine collection in Austria.
Let's send Indiana Jones after it. Joe, this has been fascinating, but we're running out of time.
Okay, well, thank you.
I just got started.
Yeah, I know. Well, you're finished. We just got started, but we have to make room for another participant in our program. It's time to go to Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. And on to the book bag with my good friend Roel Tweet.
Well, let's begin by asking something we should have asked Dr. McCaffrey at the beginning, and that is where his books are available. They are available, all of them, 10 of them, on Amazon.com, and 4 of them, and eventually all of them will be available on audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just go to audiobooks, you can pick them up. And he said they sound better, he thought, on audiobooks than they even read. That even that page he read makes me intrigued.
I was going to say I doubt that because I like reading.
Well,
let's face it.
They seem to read well.
If there's a voice I'm going to listen to, it's my own.
Right.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes here. Any recommendations?
Well, I'm going to demand equal time. We've heard from a Catholic, and it's time to hear from a Lutheran. And since this is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation,
right,
to this year, I would suggest reading, I've just finished reading, Martin Luther by Martin Marty. The big standard Lutheran production is Roland Baton's Here I Stand, but Martin Marty's is more recent, it's brief, and it is does a very accurate job of showing how and why each of Luther's main ideas, faith alone, grace, the priesthood of all believers, the idea of the two kingdoms, how and when those came into Luther's thoughts. But what it does a really good job of is showing that Luther was probably the first recipient of something going viral. When he published those 95 theses, and may or may not have actually nailed them to the wall of the door of the cathedral, he may have sent them, in fact, the printing press had just come into its own, and within 2 months, Luther's 95 Theses had gone viral. And it wasn't so much Luther that caused the Reformation, it was the rapid dissemination of his ideas to a crowd in whom resentments were already trickling down. He simply popped the cork on a huge bottle of champagne that overflowed. And beyond his control eventually. Anyway, it's a very, very good account, readable, but also scholarly.
And a seminal figure in Christianity. Luther did what had to be done. And, you know, he will always stand at that point where suddenly the reforms that people were crying out for, suddenly he started it. And it is true, the printing press was the internet of its day.
It was being published and printed all over in many different versions.
Yeah.
Instantly.
And it started a proliferation of ideas about Christianity,
right,
that continue to this day.
Well, as I said, that he was unable to control. This past year, someone published a list of the 100 most influential people in the world in the millennium. Number one is Columbus. Number two is Alexander Graham Bell. Number three, Martin Luther.
And deservedly so. Okay, well, that does it. We have enjoyed our conversation today, and we enjoy your company as well. We hope we'll see you again next week for the next edition of Scribble.